This is Ray Hanania's Column Commentary Podcast, which is available on Middle East issues and issues of American politics. You can get information at thearabdailynews.com for the Middle East side and at illinoisnewsnetwork.com for my mainstream political column. On the line with me is Mohammed S. Dajani. He is a former professor at Al-Quds University. He is one of the leading advocates of the Wasatiyah movement, which is the movement about focusing on the centrist view, the middle ground. But we're going to talk with Professor Dajani about what he's doing now and what does Wasatiyah mean and how we can achieve a Palestinian state as Palestinians. Mohammed, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for hosting me. Thank you.
Now, you 2 years ago, many people may remember your name as a Palestinian professor at Al-Quds University. You, I believe, took a group of students to the Auschwitz Nazi death camp. Why did you do that, and what happened?
Actually, the idea was to teach students about empathy and study how does empathy influence reconciliation. So basically, the idea was to take Palestinian students to visit Auschwitz to study about the suffering of the Jews during the Second World War, and then to take Israeli students to a Palestinian refugee camps so that they will study about the 1948 Nakba, and then evaluate to what extent did that experience impact their feelings towards reconciliation and peace. So now, basically, that's why we I accompanied 27 students to Auschwitz in order for them to learn about the Holocaust, about the Jewish suffering experience. And the idea basically is educational.
Right.
It was about education. It was about also we live in an environment where the Holocaust is being denied, or it's being linked to the 1948 Palestinian loss of land and property, and it is related to an ignorance of what happened, because Palestinians would tend to undermine the Holocaust and cast it away as part of the Second World War or part of a Zionist propaganda, and so we wanted to take the political context out of that issue in order to end it being a taboo in Palestinian society, and let this Palestinian society really look at the other and study the other without the political background in their minds about the other, without thinking in terms of today's occupation and today's suffering, but rather to look at it as a historic event in which the not only Jews, but it was Jews and non-Jews who suffered from the Holocaust, mainly Jews, because they were Jews. And to deny that or to underestimate the impact of that on the Jewish psyche was a very big mistake that we have actually been doing. And so it was very important for me to have these students go and visit and know for themselves and seek truth and seek knowledge. The Quran instructs us to seek knowledge. And as a result, this was part of why we did it.
Now, I know that there are many, you know, not many, but I do hear people in the Palestinian community deny the Holocaust. And as you say, your trip was to take the politics out of it. One, were you able to remove the politics out of, you know, the looking at the Holocaust and Auschwitz from a Palestinian perspective? And two, Why is it that some Palestinians feel this need to deny the Holocaust? It really had nothing to do with us. You know, we weren't involved with doing this, yet maybe in denying it, it looks like we were involved in it. How do you address that? And were you able to, you know, separate the two issues, politics and the tragedy of really millions of innocent people who died at the hands of the Nazis?
Unfortunately not. I couldn't separate politics from the humanistic side of the Holocaust tragedy. But I believe it was an important step to take, because it made many Palestinians question, why is it that we are not learning about the Holocaust? What is wrong with us? What is wrong with the whole issue? And questioning this is important, because this is a very good start. And I hope that Palestinians who, for instance, came to Auschwitz, they looked around and saw that there were people from all nationalities, so many different nationalities, yet there weren't among them Arabs or Palestinians. And the question that was on their mind, why? Why is it that there are no Palestinians coming here to see for themselves what did take place, and how horrible that this event was? To deny it, the problem is that Palestinians, in thinking of this episode, they thought that that they were fearful that the that this trip will undermine the Palestinian narrative versus the Zionist narrative or the Jewish narrative, and which is not true. And yet this is a part of the false perception within the minds of Palestinians about the Holocaust.
Well, does that come from, maybe, you know, as a Palestinian myself, you know, living in the United States, all I've ever heard was the tragedy of the Jewish people, the Holocaust, and because of what they suffered, they should be given our country. Do you think there are two aspects to this. One is it really anti-Semitism, or is it really Palestinians who fear that the Holocaust denies them, that when they acknowledge the Holocaust, it's a denial of our rights as Palestinians? And I know that's a tough thing to explore, but do you think that that's one of the factors that impacts our society as Palestinians?
Yeah, I think so, because I think that they are worried that the Holocaust justifies their dispossession of land and property and country. And so they are worried that their acknowledgement of the Holocaust would be interpreted as if allowing the Israelis to take their country or their land or their property. Part of it, and for instance, I could see that as an example. When we were at Auschwitz, one of the Jewish professors who was with us tried to explain to the students that when the Holocaust was over and Jews returned to Poland, to their homes or to other places, they found out that they had been dispossessed, and that their property was taken away from them, and they were not welcome back there, and so that the only option was for them is to go to Palestine. And so they link this link between the Holocaust and Palestine and the Nakba is part of the problem. That's why we try in our education, in our Holocaust education, not to link them, because actually there is not that much link. I don't believe that the Holocaust was the only reason that caused Jews to come to Palestine.
Right.
And Jews are talking about Jerusalem and about going back to Jerusalem for 2,000 years. And thus it is not really linked. And if we notice before that Herzl wrote his book about the Jewish state long before the Holocaust, and the Balfour Declaration was in 1917. And so basically there were Jewish efforts to go back to Zion, and the Holocaust did bring sympathy for them and did get them support, but really it is not the cause why the 1948 Palestinian catastrophe took place. And thus to link the Holocaust with the Nakba and even to compare them, I think it is wrong. I don't think it is the right thing to do. I believe that it is morally right and it is factually right not to deny the Nakba, not to deny the Holocaust, and not to deny the Nakba also.
I agree with you.
That we should, both of us, look at the suffering of the other from a humanistic side and try to show empathy for the other.
Yeah, I agree with you, Professor. I look at the Holocaust, it's something that did happen. It did happen to Jewish people. There were individuals involved from every place. They always make a big deal of, blaming Haj Amin al-Husseini, which is ridiculous. But then also there were many Americans who were involved. There were Europeans that were involved. There were many different people. The Poles were involved. So I look at the Holocaust as a tragedy that happened to a people. But I know how difficult it is for Palestinians, because we live, and maybe I don't know if you agree with this, but we live in an emotional context. I can't just wake up in the morning and not be emotional as a Palestinian, because I feel like, the tragedy is all around me. Do you think it's a relationship issue of feeling who suffered more, that we reject some of us reject the Holocaust because they feel it makes it sound like our suffering isn't enough then, that they suffered more and therefore they deserve more than we do. We didn't suffer enough. Do we have to experience a Holocaust, to find parity or equality with the Jewish people? And is that what's required in the minds of some of these people for peace?
If you look at it, the Holocaust to Jews ended in 1945. However, the 1948 Nakba of the Palestinians is still ongoing with the Israeli occupation and the denial of Palestinian self-determination right and the denial of a Palestinian state. And so that's why I noticed that when I took the students to Auschwitz, that the students were looking at the walls and the barbed wires and the prison in Auschwitz from a small picture. They were comparing it to the Israeli prisons today. They were comparing the barbed wires for the barbed wires of today. They were comparing the walls for the walls that are taking place today. And so they looked at that small picture of their suffering imposed on the suffering of the Jews and tried to see a comparison, not in terms of the magnanimous terror of what happened, but rather from a picture of the walls and of the physical things. And the Jews look at the Holocaust from a big picture. They see it as an effort to annihilate them as a civilization, as a people, as a religion, and targeting them because of their faith. And that's where I tried as a professor, as a teacher, as an educator, to bridge this gap between how the Palestinians look at the Holocaust from that small picture of what's happening today to the big picture of how Jews perceive the Holocaust. And I think once Palestinians cross the personal suffering of today's occupation and look at the Holocaust from a human perspective, then they will see it differently, and then they will see there is no harm to them or to their cause in learning about the Holocaust. On the contrary, I think it will give them credit that they are overcoming their own suffering to show empathy with their perpetrators or with their occupiers. And in this way, I believe that the world will look at them differently from the way the world is looking at them now, in when they deny the Holocaust, or they underestimate it, or rationalize it, or claim that it is the numbers are not correct, or that it is part of the Second World War massacres, or whatever reasons that they present for their position. And I feel that this taboo topic in Palestinian society should end, and we have to face it, and we have to talk about it, and we have to study it. Basically, also, I feel it is a problem of education, because there isn't one single book in Palestinian library that really talks about the Holocaust from a humanistic side or historical side of what has happened. The only few books that has been published about the Holocaust were to deny the Holocaust or to claim that this is a Zionist plot, and while there are no books about documenting the Holocaust, you will see that books such as the Elders of Zion, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, is being published in different versions and being popularly circulated, whether in Palestine or in the Arab world. And so this fictional view about Jews feeds anti-Semitism, and anti-Semitism feeds anti-Jewish, and anti-Jewish then supports, feeds this denial of the Holocaust. So it is all linked together, and that's why we try to work for peace and reconciliation, and part of our work is really to tackle this problem.
Now, I know that, and by the way, Professor, I think this is so important because, as you point out, we really don't talk about this issue, yet it's such a major factor sometimes in the dialogue that's out there among Israelis, among Jews, among Palestinians, and among Arabs. I do know, some might say that just as some Palestinians and Arabs deny the Holocaust, are there not Israelis and Jews who deny, you know, the suffering of the Palestinians that we've experienced? In other words, they tend to look at the denial of the Holocaust in the context of the denial by Israelis of Palestinian suffering. And they too, don't they deny, you know, what has happened to us? And how do you reconcile that? How do we deal with that?
I think if you show empathy to your enemy, then eventually your enemy might show empathy for you, for your suffering. I believe that when you do good to people, then it will be very difficult for people to respond by doing evil to you. And thus, in taking this step in, to show empathy for my occupier, I'm hoping that my occupier will show empathy for my own suffering. And I want to arouse, like, for instance, acts of good that the other can do to me, will awaken the humanity in me and will awaken the good in me. I'm hoping that the humanity in me and the good in me will awaken the humanity and the good in the other. And that's why if we focus on actions of good that has been done, where a Jewish soldier is helping rather than tormenting or torturing a Palestinian, or a Jewish doctor, or a Jewish nurse. And in this way, if we focus on these incidents of doing good to the other, then I'm hoping that, and I'm expecting also that the other will start to look at me positively rather than negatively. I want to look, and instead of seeing a Jewish soldier who is tormenting a Palestinian, I would like to see a Jewish soldier who is helping a Palestinian. And that's why I'm totally against the occupation and for the establishment of a Palestinian state with full rights for Palestinians, because I feel that unless we deal with the issue of justice and end the status of injustice, we cannot achieve peace and we cannot achieve coexistence. We have to end this hatred to each other and this enmity, and try to live in a way that will, in which our children will inherit a better future than the present. That's why I believe strongly that we have to understand the other, we have to learn about the other, we have to study the other, and at the same time the other should study us and should learn about us. And I'm hoping that with this building of bridges between both communities, that we can achieve reconciliation in midst of conflict. That's why I don't believe that reconciliation should wait till the end of conflict, but rather in the midst of conflict, so that people would that this would pave the way for peaceful settlement and a peaceful and just settlement between Israelis and Palestinians.
We're talking with Professor Mohammed Dejani. He actually was the professor of the American Studies Department and I believe director of the library at Al-Quds University in East Jerusalem. He took a group of 27 students to Auschwitz in March 2014. Tell us, Professor, if you don't mind, what happened after the trip? Because there's so many stories about what happened to you, where you are today. If this impacted your career and your life, explain what happened and why you think it happened.
A number of reasons that did take place before going to on the trip. There were efforts to actually convince students not to join the trip, and two students dropped out because of the pressures on them not to be part of the trip. At the same time, I was warned not to go and to cancel the trip, and I received an email from the president of my university saying, I heard rumors that you are taking your students to Auschwitz, and I if these rumors are true, then I would like to explain to them and that this is not a university activity, and this is not part of the university curriculum, and this is not part of. And that this is part of your organization, the Wasatiyya movement activities. Well, and then I responded to him saying, yes, this is exactly what I'm telling my students. And but to me, it was very surprising that the university will dissociate itself from such an important educational trip.
President of the university at the time, I thought there was a president at the time who was very supportive of the peace process, or am I mistaken? Was this a different, you know, without getting into names, was the administration supportive of the peace process at the time, or was it just this specific issue of the Holocaust that they were upset about?
I think the pressures on the university from outside and from inside may have played a role there.
Got it.
And thus maybe it influenced the way they looked at it. Also, it was a shift in policy because the policy of joining academically with Israeli universities or working with them has been cancelled because of the Gaza war, and the Al-Quds University has started a new policy of anti-normalization and boycotting other Israeli universities, when before they had more than 50 joint projects with them. But when the Gaza war did take place, there was a lot of pressure on the university to change its policy. So I believe he was under pressure from the radical factions on campus and outside campus, particularly that the Holocaust has been sensitive among Palestinians because of what has been mentioned. And so that's why the attitude.
So it was kind of a timing issue too. I mean, at the time that you decided to do this, it wasn't really so much the university, but the environment, in other words. The relations exactly. between yeah. Israel and the Palestinians were not that great. Within a couple months after your trip, the war broke out in Gaza, the tensions had been, you know, so bad. It really wasn't a very good time. But also,
the U.S. initiative had broken down.
Right.
And people who felt hope with the Kerry initiative for peace and for negotiations, when the negotiations broke down and nothing happened, so that also impacted the way people feel, that they felt this is not the time to learn about the Holocaust when the Israelis are thinking that there is no Palestinian peace partner and that they are closing down the negotiations. So they thought this had that impact on it.
It would weaken the pressure on the Israelis, in other words.
Yeah. The general mood was at that time politically charged. At the same time, also that there were incitements again against the trip, because the Haaretz published an article about the trip in which talked about the who funded the trip, saying it was funded by the DFG, which is a German research foundation, and who sponsored the trip, that it was sponsored by the Reconciliation Center at the Friedrich Schiller University in Jena, Germany. Yet, when the article was translated to Arabic, it said that the trip was funded by Zionist organizations, and it was sponsored by Tel Aviv, by Israeli universities, which was not true. And so I think that this gave it the look, or it made people perceive it as if it is a Zionist propaganda to improve the image of Israelis at a time when they felt that the Israelis were blocking peace and were against the negotiations in order to keep confiscating land and to keep the occupation, the status quo of the occupation.
Were you disappointed in the Arab and Palestinian media that they did, that they allowed this to come out that way? Because I do recall that the accusation was it was funded by the Israelis and the Zionists, and as you say, that was totally untrue. Was there a disappointment in your mind about our own media that we couldn't even get the facts right in terms of describing what happened?
Actually, you cannot get the facts wrong this way. And you cannot look and read that when you read it is funded by a German research foundation and it is sponsored by a German or a university, and then put that in writing as
Zionist
organizations and Israeli universities. This cannot be something that just happens. I think it is more intentional. It is not
an accident, right?
Yeah, no, yeah. And also the what made it worse is that the university issued a statement saying that they have not, they had nothing to do with the trip, which made people think, yes, this trip is wrong.
Right.
And it gave the perception that the trip is wrong and the professor who did it against the educational norms of the university. And so, and then when the syndicate of teachers and workers at the university issued a statement saying that they are firing me from their membership, and then the students, this incited students to start demonstrations, and they came to my office and left me with my secretary a life-threatening communique, which the university took, by the way, although it was addressed to me, the university took, and when I asked the president to have a copy of it, he said he didn't have a copy because he gave it to the police to investigate it. Yet, it should, I should have had that message because at that time, it was my life that was threatened. And yet, they camouflaged the whole problem, and then they didn't give me any support. And they said, and under that condition, I was forced to submit my resignation. And then they claim that they tried to convince me to withdraw it, which is not true. And yet they did not have the courage to reject it or to say no. And in saying no to my resignation, they would have sent a message to the public that they support me. But they did not do that. And on the contrary, they accepted my resignation.
Now, were you, did you feel forced to submit your resignation? I mean, explain what happened to you personally. Explain how your career changed. Was this you deciding that this was too dangerous because of the threat on your life that you had to resign? Or was it because you felt there was no one to support you, no one to stand up for academic freedom around you? What happened
yeah,
to
it
you?
It is both, because when somebody asked me, what was more hurtful to you, and leaving your career, leaving your post as rector of the libraries or and the director of the American Studies Center, or the fact that you were labeled as traitor and collaborator? And my response was neither. The words in the most the most thing that impacted my feelings was that I looked around and I did not find one single academic person to support me. On the contrary, the hypocrites started claiming that I forced my students and that this is not an educational trip, and they started to deny facts and post on their websites things to support the university position. And so this is where, this is why I felt that I cannot teach under this environment, and I cannot be present physically under an environment where there is such a threat, and I needed support, and I needed the university to support me first, because the university gave the right for university faculty to do joint projects with Israelis on their own personal responsibility, which is what I did. And so they should have said that. At the same time, they should have stressed that this is an educational trip and that they support such educational trips because of the fact that of the fact that this is about learning, about knowledge, about and I've been doing that anyway for the last and during my tenure as professor, to take my students to abroad and to take them to trips. And so this was not a unique event that I took students to trip. I once took students to Antalya, Turkey, to attend a workshop on peace education. I used to take students to every year for the last 3 years. Before that, to Oberlin College in Ohio, where they met Israeli students and American students and worked together for 3 weeks. So it was not, these trips were not something new. And this is what the university should have said, and that this is part of a university curriculum to take students outside the campus, to have them learn to have them learn and seek education, not only in books, but in the field. And that's where the university failed, and that's where the university did not live up to its educational vision. And part of that...
Sorry. No, I was going to say that, and just also a side note here, just before I think this happened, wasn't there a controversy that pushed out Sari Nusseibeh from the El-Quds as the president of the university in Jerusalem? Didn't something happen like a few months before or right about the time of your trip? It looked like there was a big campaign to crack down on people who believed in normalization as a strategy to establish Palestinian statehood.
Yes, there was, and actually his position on the refugees did not earn him much popularity among Palestinians, and so the issue of normalization, he tried to balance his position in order to save his legacy and his image among Palestinians, but it didn't help much in the sense that Palestinians feeling that there is nothing else to do, so their misperception that anti-normalization is the answer. And so there was a lot of pressure on the university to adopt such a policy. And I don't think it was the right policy, because I don't think that in our Palestinian-Israeli conflict what we need is boycotts and anti-normalization. On the contrary, what we need is building trust and building through dialogue. And in order to be able to move from a state of conflict to a state of reconciliation. And I don't think that the anti-normalization movement is helpful in that direction, because all what it does is to empower the extreme right in the Israeli camp and the anti-peace extremists and radicals. And so as a result, it does not allow us the people-to-people contact. It doesn't allow us the human response in the sense of getting to know each other on the human level, to trust each other in order to build peace among each other. Because peace will not be imposed from the outside, and it will not be imposed by a peace treaty. Peace should be between people. And as far as building walls and building all these fences, it does not help to build bridges of peace between the two people.
I agree with you, Professor, that you know, anger gives our people, sometimes anger and emotion gives us a short-term feeling of victory. We feel this short moment of satisfaction in our anger by boycotting, by refusing to talk, by rejecting, rejecting normalization. But I agree with you that normalization really is the path to Palestinian statehood, and that by building up friendships among the Israelis, genuine friendships through respect, that we can build a solid ground. And I think the extremists know that. I think the extremists know that normalization weakens them. But how do we, what do we do? Because today, as you know, the peace movement is weak. The extremists on both sides are strong. The normalization, the anti-normalization, you know, campaign is strong. How do people like you and I and others in the Palestinian and Israeli and Jewish community, how do we turn this around so that we could come back to, you know, the possibility of having true compromise based on mutual recognition and Palestinian statehood? What do you think needs to be done? I know it's a tough question.
I believe that we need to make the voice of moderation louder and louder so that it can be heard. I believe that we have to awaken the Palestinian people to the fact that their leaders are lying to them, and they are just feeding them misperception. The anti-normalization movement gives the perception that something is being done when nothing is being done by it. It is the same story like that we were taught when we were young about Caliph Omar ibn al-Khattab, that he used to go around the city at night to see what is going on. And then he heard voices of children crying. So he went to the place where the children were crying, and he saw children sitting there crying. And then there is this old woman who had put stones on in a kettle boiling with water, and she was boiling the stones. And then he was very surprised. He said, "Old woman, what are you doing? Why are you boiling these stones when the kids are crying?" She said that I do that in order to, I'm a very poor woman, I don't have food, and these kids are hungry, and that's why they are crying. And I boil the stones in order to give them the impression I'm cooking food for them. Yet, they after a while, they get tired, and then they sleep, and then I go to sleep. So basically, I think the same is happening with us, in the sense that people in their despair and in their frustration are thinking something is being done with this anti-normalization movement. And so they feed themselves the illusion that eventually that they will be victorious because of this anti-normalization movement, or because of this boycott movement, when in reality what this anti-normalization movement and BDS and boycott movement, what it is doing, it is making the Israeli state get larger and larger by the land that is being confiscated every day from the Palestinian territories, and making the state of Palestine get smaller and smaller, to the extent that people started to believe the myth that the two-state solution is dead. I believe that this is premature announcement. The two-state solution is not dead. It is there. It is on the ground. And all the land that has been expropriated after Oslo Accords of 1993 are illegal, and the building of settlement in post the Oslo Accords period is also illegal internationally and by Israeli law, even, because the Israelis have recognized the Palestinian entity as it was pre-1993. And so any land that has been confiscated in post-1993 Oslo Accords are illegally, even according to Israeli laws and the international laws. So that's why we have to revive peace, and we have to work on reconciliation and work on trying to live together and understand each other and show empathy for each other.
Professor Dajani, listen, I so appreciate you taking the time to talk about this. I think it's important that we work together, that we, you know, the community is lost in a way. There doesn't seem to be a lot of support for people like you, me, and others. I think we need to reach out together and build our own new coalition of peace, and I think what you're doing is the right thing and is good, and we need to support it. So I just wanted to tell you how much I support what you're doing, and that I believe that this is the only path to statehood for Palestinians, and I just hope that we can continue and work together and maybe build this into a movement rather than trying to turn to the other existing organizations that really seem to be operating out of fear rather than positive movement forward. How do people get a hold of you if they're interested in more information on the Wasatiyah movement?
We are on Facebook, and on we have a website called Wasatiyah, and my email is msdajanidaoudi@gmail.com, and it's msdajanidaoudi@gmail.com, and they can get in touch with us on Facebook also. We have more than 15 groups working on Facebook in order to use the social networks to combat the hate messages that has been posted or are being posted, and to empower the positive messages that are being posted. We should not keep the other from stifling our voices. We need to make our voices heard, and we should not be discouraged, or we should not be a threat. We should not be afraid to express ourselves and express what we believe in a loud voice.
All right. With me this morning has been Professor Mohammed Dajani. He is the founder of the Wasatiyah movement, or one of the leaders of the Wasatiyah movement, which is basically about reconciliation. And he's been generous enough to take this time to talk to us about his experiences and what needs to be done. Professor, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much for hosting me. Thank you.
All right. I'm Ray Hanania, and this is my column commentary podcast. I have several websites online where you can get information. RayHanania.com, TheMediaOasis.com, TheArabDailyNews.com, and IllinoisNewsNetwork.com. You can always friend me on Facebook at RG Hanania. And, of course, you can send me an email at rghanania@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.